WC132469, State versus Chin. Arguing for the petitioner, William A. Harrison, Law Offices of Harrison and Matsuoka. Arguing for the respondent, Sonia P. McCullen, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
Well, good evening. Aloha, everyone. The court's honored to be here at the William S. Richardson School of Law. Mr. Harrison and Ms. McCullen, are you ready to argue tonight?
We are.
All right. And my understanding is you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Harrison, so we'll give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. And with 10 minutes to go in your argument, Ms. McCullen will give you a warning as well. Please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chief Justice, members of the court. This case is really about fundamental fairness. That's what it simply boils down to. Appellant Susan Chin was involved in a trial. She was charged with 6 counts, which included theft, attempted theft, as well as money laundering counts. In the third day of trial, her main witness was in the restroom. And while he was in the restroom, one of the jurors approached him and asked him if he could assist him in getting a job. Gave the witness his card, his business card, and left the restroom. Prior to trial in this case, obviously, the court instructed the jurors, as well as all the witnesses, as well as the parties to the proceeding, not to have any contact with the jurors, and the jurors were not to have any contact with us. The only contact that was allowed would be, you know, your formal greeting contacts, good morning, good afternoon, and such. That was it. He was instructed not to have any contact. This juror ultimately became the foreperson of the jury. The jurors, unfortunately, convicted my client of 3 counts of 6 counts in this matter. After the verdict came down, the witness notified me that he had been contacted by the juror, asked me about the juror, and I explained to him that the juror was a foreperson. And at that point in time, we filed a motion for a new trial before the trial court.
Mr. Harrison, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but could you help me with that sequence of events? Because it appears from the record that the communication took place during the time of the trial, the communication between the witness and the juror, and then that was reported to your client. Didn't your client report that to you?
No, I heard about the matter after the trial, and we filed a motion at that point. As soon as we heard about it, I followed up, I contacted the witness, I spoke to the witness, he provided the facts of the actual contact, and we prepared a declaration.
And at that time, Mr. Bowen informed you that he had told your client during the trial that there had been this contact with the witness?
That's correct.
Thank you.
And so we proceeded to file the motion for the trial. We had a hearing on it. It was a very brief hearing. The judge denied the motion for the trial and ordered the state to prepare findings of facts and conclusions of the laws, as generally happens in these proceedings. In the findings of fact, conclusion of the law, the court indicated that one of the reasons why the motion was not granted is because the appellant could not provide the court with any specific facts as to how it prejudiced her in her trial, i.e., we couldn't prove that this incident was communicated to any other jurors. We could not show that this juror, in fact, had not done something or done something relative to this communication, i.e., he wanted a job. And the natural inference is that he didn't get the job because, as the declaration of the witness indicated, he never called this gentleman back. So that leaves a question with us as to, does this affect my client's right to a fair trial? I think that the case law in this area, it generally says, under the circumstances, and specifically in our jurisdiction here, we have a two-step approach to determine whether, in fact, we get a hearing on this matter. And that's what really we really wanted to have. We wanted to have a hearing. We wanted the judge to call the juror in, to question the juror as to why that juror violated the court's order. What was the reason for that violation? And specifically, obviously, did it have any relevance in terms of the deliberative process that took place in the case?
Well, Mr. Harrison, our standard of review here is abuse of discretion.
That's correct.
And you know, how can we find on this record that the trial court's conclusion that it was wholly speculative that there was any impact is an abuse of discretion with that highly deferential standard?
Well, the problem is here is that the appellant didn't get a right to have that issue before this court, i.e. the appellant did not have a right to get and garner facts. As we pointed out in our papers to the court, under the rules of professional conduct, we cannot contact the jurors without the court's permission. And one of the questions we asked the court at that time was, could we have the right to contact? And the court indicated no. And we asked specifically, could we have the right to have the court then bring the juror in and question the juror as to the motives and as to why the juror decided to pursue this.
Mr. Harrison, following up on what the Chief Justice said, I mean, doesn't the trial judge have the discretion initially to make a determination of whether or not there was influence of a nature which would substantially prejudice the right to a fair trial and make that initial determination? And if it looks like there's such an influence that could substantially prejudice the right, and at that point do an inquiry? So she exercised her discretion here and found that there was not such an influence, correct?
Well, the problem here is that we disagree with the court's decision relative to that. And the reason why is this, is that we have a direct inappropriate contact. It's not a situation where we can look at it and say, okay, it's an inadvertent contact. This is a contact that the foreperson in this case made to the witness who was our main witness.
Is it your position under that situation there wasn't any discretion with the trial judge? The trial judge at that time was bound to conduct an inquiry because that alone constituted evidence that there was an influence of a nature that would substantially influence?
Our position is at that point, based on those facts, yes, the court was to, at that point, conduct further inquiry.
I'm sorry to interrupt. Do you want to finish your answer?
I want to point to the Dillard case. It basically says in that situation where you have that kind of conduct, fundamental fairness dictates that it has to be an inquiry. Now, the nature of the inquiry can be limited, and the courts and different courts have dealt with the limited inquiry. But there was no inquiry here. There was nothing other than the motions denied. It's pure speculation as to what his thought processes were.
Mr. Harrison, you've just agreed to a question where somebody asked you if abuse of discretion was the appropriate standard. Now, our case law may articulate that, but does that mean that if I'm in one court and I put it forward, the facts, what occurred, that judge in his discretion say, no hearing. I go to the next court, same facts, and the judge exercises her discretion, and she says, oh, you get a hearing. So we have identical facts, and I'm going to get a hearing in one court and not a hearing in another court?
Are you asking me we're talking about a lower court and an appellate court, or are we talking about two?
I'm talking about the lower court. There's been someone asks you a question, and you acknowledge that the lower court has the discretion. And I'm wondering if, isn't the court making factual findings as to whether or not the facts merit an evaluation?
Well, they have to make factual findings.
So how, along the lines of what Justice Pollack is asking, how can that actually be an abuse of discretion standard? Isn't it really a clearly erroneous standard as to whether or not the defendant has borne the initial burden of making a prima facie showing of a deprivation that could substantially prejudice her right to a fair trial?
Well, you know, the Bailey case, I think, which I believe Chief Justice Rechtenwald had written, I believe it was the Bailey case, looked into that issue as to the standards, whether it's clearly erroneous or whether it is, in fact, discretionary. And the line of cases that ultimately was cited and it was determined that it is an abuse of discretion standard actually talked about the Dillard case and talked about other cases from other jurisdictions that wrestled with this issue relative to what standard did we apply here. And what I'm saying here is that when the court, in that specific factual situation where we have a declaration under oath of a witness saying, he contacted me, he approached me, he asked me for a job, and I didn't know what to do, I didn't respond to him. And that information gets communicated to a court. It's our position it's abuse of discretion if the court does not, at that point, at least have a minimum inquiry.
Don't you think the test is a little bit confusing? It starts off by saying when a defendant claims a deprivation, the initial step is for the trial court to determine whether the nature of the alleged deprivation rises to the level of being substantially prejudicial. If it doesn't arise to that level, the trial court is under no duty to interrogate. So that suggests that the trial court gets to decide whether or not it, and it says it's a discretionary thing, you know, it's that determination is left to the trial court's discretion. So the trial, it says that the trial court has a discretion of determining whether or not it arises to the level of being substantially prejudicial. But then at the end, it says the defendant bears the initial burden of making a prima facie showing of a deprivation that could substantially prejudice.
And that's a difficult situation for the defendant to do, especially in a case such as this, where he doesn't have the right to have that juror come in and further discuss what had happened. And I agree with you that what does it mean to be in the situation that the alleged deprivation rises to a level of being substantially prejudiced? What does that mean? And if you look at the cases, they're all over the place as to what specifically you have to do in order to reach that point. And I point out one of the cases in which individual brought in a dictionary into the deliberation room, and the court inquired of the juror. In that case, put the jurors in and inquired as to what happened with that dictionary. And the foreperson spoke, and the foreperson said that the dictionary wasn't used. We had some questions about some words previous day. We cleared up that issue. The one juror brought in the dictionary wasn't open, wasn't used. But the court in that situation said, just by bringing the dictionary in, the inquiry must continue beyond that, and just inquiring of the foreperson is not sufficient to meet the test to determine if there was fundamental fairness in that trial. And so in that case, the matter was reversed. And it's a similar thing. The dictionary is no different than a direct communication to our witness in the bathroom. And I would ask this court to take a look at that and analogize
well,
that.
If you could help me with that, point. Mr. Harrison, because many of the cases that have been mentioned in your materials and cases that you mentioned that have a lot of discussion about circumstances in which there has been substantial prejudice found because of outside communication involve issues of deliberation. Maybe a dictionary, for example, or, as you know, issues about whether or not during deliberations the discussion took place about the defendant's failure to testify. That's been significant in a number of cases. But in those cases, there's sort of a focus on some communication that took place during deliberations. So here we have a communication that takes place not with respect to deliberations. It's sort of a separate matter that has to do with employment of a juror. So would you say that a distinction needs to be made there? Because after all, the judge has to make this first cut, if you will, as Justice McKenna was saying, the way the standard is right now, as to whether the evidence presented could substantially prejudice the right to a fair trial. And how much of a prejudice does that constitute, seeing somebody in the hallway or in the bathroom and having a short conversation?
Well, it could actually very much prejudice my client. I'll give you some examples. The foreperson goes back. The witness doesn't call him. And so when they're deliberating and discussing witness credibility, Bowen's case name comes up, Charles Bowen, who was a witness in the bathroom. What is the foreperson? What might he say in that situation? I don't believe the guy. He's not credible. Okay, why? Because that juror had interactions with the witness outside of the courtroom.
The government made a curious argument about that. Didn't they argue that you couldn't show that it was discussed? On the other hand, you couldn't call the juror.
That's exactly right. We're in a catch-22 situation. In order for us to make our burden, we should be able to garner facts to show that that's an issue that the court needs to deal with. And we were handcuffed during our motion because the court said no.
Mr. Harrison,
we're not going to call that juror.
You're alleging that the court erred by not allowing a further hearing and interviewing the in this case, the four-person in the jury.
Is at minimum, that's correct.
At a minimum. So what remedy are you seeking now? Can we remand it and have the court interview the four-person?
I think it's too late for that. I think
why is that?
There was a right to a new trial because time has passed. Number one, it's not right after the event happened, within a few weeks after the event happened. We are now two, three years down the line since this has happened.
Don't you have to call the witness first to see whether or not it's too long or whether the witness can recall or?
Well, the problem here is that, first off, we don't know, number one, if my client's rights have been prejudiced. Okay? We don't know that. And so we're assuming at this point, at least the trial court assumed, that it wasn't. Okay? I'm assuming that it is. Right? Mm-hmm. At this point, I'm demanding that we have a new trial because when I requested that procedure to be taken, undertaken, it was not afforded us.
What's the reason for it being too late? I mean, don't you have to give a reason for it besides just saying it's too late?
Well, you know, when we talk about justice in our courtrooms, one of the things we talk about is a right to a speedy trial, is a right to conduct our proceedings in an expeditious manner because witnesses' memories, they lose their memories after a period of time. The juror in this case might have forgotten about what his thought processes were when he entered that bathroom to give the juror a business card in direct contravention to the court order in this case. So that time lapse, I think, violated my client's rights in this case to a fair and speedy trial. She had demanded at the time that the court
take
steps.
She's already had a trial, right?
But we're saying it wasn't a fair trial. It wasn't a fair trial because fundamental fairness says that we address those kinds of issues right when they're before the court and not sometime in the future.
You know, the United States Supreme Court has apparently said in Maddox versus United States that private communications, possibly prejudicial between jurors and witnesses, are absolutely forbidden and invalidate the verdict, at least until the harmlessness is made to appear. In other words, unless it's shown that it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So do you actually think that our test comports with the United States Supreme Court and the United States Constitution?
I wanted to address that issue. Absolutely, the U.S. Constitution says in the Sixth Amendment right to fair trial, in that situation, then it becomes the burden of the state to show that the person had a fundamentally fair trial. Our test actually puts the burden on the defense to come forward and then show the court why it's presumed prejudicial based on the facts.
Mr. Harrison, taken literally, wouldn't that case, if there were a casual good morning between the juror and the witness, wouldn't that then implicate or suggest there has to immediately be a voir dire of the juror? Is that what you're arguing for?
No, because as I remember, federal practice, the judges always tell the jurors that there's no communications. It's okay to say hi and bye, but that's it. And then that's not the situation we have here. Clearly, if we had that situation, I wouldn't be here arguing before you. The situation goes much deeper than that because we don't know if that juror, and especially since he's a four-person, utilized that interaction in any way to decide what was going to happen in the case, both personally or influencing other jurors. Because obviously they go through the process of communicating with one another in the deliberation room, and they're trying to convince the fellow jurors as to their point of view. So if he, at that point in time, decided that, you know what, you know, I was straightforward with this gentleman, I gave him my card, he didn't contact me, then I'm going to believe X, or I'm going to do Y. And that's what we can't have in that jury room.
Mr. Harrison, is it your position then that the judge, when the judge decided under those facts, it was mere speculation that there would be substantial prejudice, that there was no discretion on her part, and that was abuse of discretion, or if you want to apply clearly erroneous, that as a matter of law under these facts,
if
there
that's
has
the standard
to be an inquiry?
Yes, if that's the standard that I'm required to meet here, I would absolutely say yes, that under those facts, that the court had to, at that point, do further inquiry. Otherwise,
as you're suggesting that maybe the jurors were told something by this particular person that might have been prejudicial. But when you consider the nature of the communication that took place between the juror and the witness, it didn't have anything to do with deliberations, right? It didn't have to do with a dictionary. It didn't have to do with whether they were considering information they were instructed not to consider. So I'm just making sure that I'm not missing something. You're saying that under no circumstances would there be discretion if there's a contact between a juror and a witness. There would be no discretion unless, I guess, there was some instruction from the judge saying it's okay to say hello, but there would be no discretion, and as a matter of law, it would be necessary to engage in an inquiry because that episode could be seen as substantially prejudicial to a fair trial.
Well, I'm saying under the facts of this case, I'm not saying going into the elevator saying hi and bye in the morning or the afternoon is the type of conduct that we should be concerned about. I'm specifically addressing conduct here.
And was it the request that was made, the fact that there was a request made by the juror of a witness? Is that what is the operative reason that you say that under no circumstances could discretion be applied to say that there was no real, that couldn't arise to substantial prejudice?
There's actually two reasons here. The first reason is the juror was specifically instructed to do something, and then the court also instructed the jurors that they are the judge of the facts in the case, but they have to follow the instructions. And the question then becomes whether he, number one, would follow instructions, not only in that scenario, but when he's required to apply the law to the facts, would he follow instructions in that scenario? But additionally, we have the issue of the possible prejudicial impact. And of course, I don't know what he was thinking at the time. I don't know what he did in his deliberative process because we weren't allowed to inquire about that.
And can you actually inquire as to that?
As to how he deliberated, no. But we can inquire as to, number one, why did you violate the court's order? And two, what was the purpose of that violation? And if there's no further questions, I want to say.
I just had one further. So, good morning. That's not a problem. What if the witness has a Pittsburgh Steelers monogrammed polo shirt on and the juror walks by and says, "Go Steelers"? Is that a problem?
I don't think in that situation that would be a problem. You know? We're talking about situations where, you know, that's almost a greeting. If you're a Steelers fan and another Steelers fan goes by, you're going to greet that person. I don't have any problem with that. I do have a problem when we get into specific information surreptitiously in a bathroom that you were told not to communicate with the person. That's the problem.
Now, following up on Justice Wilson's question, the state argues this had nothing to do with the case whatsoever, not about the evidence, not about the testimony, completely unrelated. That, in your mind, is not a line. This, nevertheless, even though that's, I assume you would agree, is a case, nevertheless, this communication, you think, is still problematic.
It's very problematic, and as I said, for the two reasons. Number one, he did not follow instructions, and that's important.
Let me ask you, there's an assumption that it had nothing to do with the trial. I thought that it was, he gave him a card, said, I'm interested in a job. The card had his cell number, his phone number, his fax number, his email on it, and said, I'm interested in his job. And that was related specifically to his testimony where he had testified that I have top secret clearance. So I'm not sure how it doesn't relate to the testimony.
Thank you. And I would agree with you. It obviously relates because of the fact that that's the whole reason why he came to this individual, based on that individual's testimony. And then again, that could shade his decision not to contact that poor person, obviously could infect that poor person's thinking and also his manner in which he deliberated in the deliberation room.
How about something that's maybe more common here, like, hey, did you go to Kailua High School and graduate with, I think you graduated with my brother.
Well, we have a more problem there.
Okay, so how about that?
Yeah, that goes a little bit further than high and by.
Right.
And, you know, Hell of a Steeler fan.
Right.
We're talking about trying to inquire relative to that person's background, maybe possibly determining whether there's any knowledge of that individual, his family. And again, we start our voir dire process, one of the things we want to weed out is that the person knows someone else in the courtroom, and then we get to, at least at that point, voir dire that juror as to how that may or may not affect that person's ability to be fair and impartial. So clearly, that goes beyond the high and by, and I would say that we run into problems in that regard as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Gerson. Ms. McCullen.
May it please the court, Sonia McCullen on behalf of the state of Hawaii. Contrary to defense contention, the circuit court did not abuse its discretion here because the witness's declaration on its face did not establish substantial prejudice. And I'll start with addressing Justice McKenna's concern about the confusion in some of these in the framework put forth in Furutani. It's a little confusing. And I think State v. Kim, I think it was State v. Kim, helped set it out a little better. Basically, my understanding is the defendant first has the burden of making a prima facie showing of a deprivation, two things, a deprivation, and not only just a deprivation, but that it could substantially prejudice her right to a fair trial by an impartial jury. Two cases, Yamada and Kim, kind of help explain how you meet this prima facie burden. One is, the defendant must show an objective evaluation that the contact was improper. And two, Yamada says that the defendant was somehow prejudiced by the contact. And Kim says that the contact was used as a circumstance against her. And
so your argument is that you have to show the prejudice even before you put on, you're entitled to call the juror.
You have to show that the deprivation, so in this case the contact, could substantially prejudice the defendant's right to fair trial. You have to make that showing. And then Yamada says you can do it one way by saying that the defendant was somehow prejudiced by the contact. And Kim says by showing that the contact was used as a circumstance against the defendant.
In other words, contact being used against, again, you're showing prejudice. So yes. Under both of those formulations, you're saying you have to show prejudice before you have the right to call the juror.
Yes.
So let's take a situation where there's a dictionary discovered in a jury room or a newspaper is discovered in the room. How could you possibly satisfy your test if you don't know if anybody even picked it up or read it?
Okay, that's a little different than the circumstance we have here because we're not attacking a verdict yet at that point, if I understand.
No, we are attacking. I'm talking about a situation where the dictionary is found in the jury room after the verdict comes down, or a newspaper, which are two cases that we've had here in Hawaii.
Okay, that deals with extraneous evidence being introduced into the jury room. And that has been shown in our case law that that is enough to demonstrate that it could prejudice the defendant's right to a fair trial. So that's established, I think.
So this, you don't characterize this situation as extraneous?
As extraneous evidence being introduced into the jury room? No.
It's not an extraneous influence. We don't know if it went into the jury room.
Yeah, we don't. So again, it's the defendant's burden to make that prima facie showing. And all the defendant presented was the declaration, Mr. Bowen's declaration. And
so what was the defendant supposed to do? What was the defendant supposed to do here? Other than going to the court and asking for permission to talk to the juror, was there anything else the defendant could have done to try to unravel whether there was some prejudice?
Yeah, well, there were two people at this contact. There was the defendant. There was the witness and the juror. Now the defendant is she needs to call in the juror, and that's the only way she's going to find out if there's prejudice. But there was another person there, the witness, and the witness
reported
in the conversation
and reported on what happened.
Yes, and what he reported it shows, it doesn't show any prejudice. And it, that's when it's important to look at defendant's
theory. How can the defendant establish prejudice then?
It could have been whatever, explaining what happened during that contact. Did the exactly what was said? This all it says is approached about, inquired about the possibility of employment. It doesn't say they what? Discussed the trial, the evidence, doesn't say they discussed the witness's testimony.
That's not, in the state's view, that inquiry in and of itself is not enough then to be possibly prejudicial.
It shows the improper.
You would concede then, if we go on under State versus Kim, would the state concede that the contact was improper?
Yes.
Okay. So then the issue is, from the state's view, you have an issue of whether or not the defendant was prejudiced by the contact, or the contact was prejudicial. Did you say those
Correct.
Were the ways?
So
my question is, how could the defendant actually establish that?
Depending on what happened in the contact, the witness was there.
But the defendant's not in the jury room. How could the defendant is not in the mind of the juror? How could the defendant actually ever establish that?
Anything that happened, if the witness included in his declaration, Katie told me I had to call back by this date, or she would be convicted. That if I didn't give him a job, it wouldn't help this defendant. It would hurt. Or if I did give him a job, this would help the defendant.
Let me ask you this. Do you think that our test that says that the trial judge has the discretion at the outset, and I thank you for pointing out that I agree. I think the first step is for the defendant to establish a prima facie case. So you do think that that is the first step?
Yes.
Okay. So you agree then that the way this test is stated in some of our cases, which says that the initial step is for the trial court to determine whether or not there's substantial prejudice. And the trial court has the discretion of making that determination. You would agree that's not actually the first step?
Yes.
Okay. So how about the United States Supreme Court's Maddox case, private communications possibly prejudicial between jurors and witnesses are absolutely forbidden and invalidate the verdict, at least unless it's shown to be harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Two things with Maddox. One, if I recall correctly, the United States Supreme, Maddox is like an 1895 case.
Has it been overruled?
Well, not overruled. But in later cases, the U.S. Supreme Court itself said that not every contact between a juror and witness is automatically reversible. And this court itself, in Carpenter v. Honolulu Rapid Transit, has addressed the Maddox case and has specifically said that the Maddox case is an extraordinary circumstance that required a deviation from the general rule that we don't call back jurors.
Is that a civil or criminal case, Carpenter?
It's a civil case. But it was also cited in, I forget.
Well, so, Ms. McCollum, could I ask you, in line with this idea about the nature of the prejudice that will apply with external influences. The case law is interesting in that regard, and you seem to suggest that there might be a case that involves contact between a juror and a witness where the decision of the court was that there was not a basis for questioning the juror. I was wondering, can you cite to any case in which there has been contact between a witness and a juror and the court has found that there wasn't justification to question?
Not that I'm aware of.
Because We do have it is an older case too, but the Bocchini case, which is where there was a type of contact that wouldn't necessarily relate directly to deliberations. That's where one of the jurors was knitting a lot, and the bailiff said, you know, if you stop your knitting, maybe you can do your job as a juror. And in that case, it was found that the inquiry that took place wasn't sufficient, where the judge asked some questions about whether the juror would have been affected in her deliberations by this, and she said no, and the court said that wasn't sufficient. Counsel should have been given more opportunity to question. And in that case, the court said that it's the historic policy of zealously protecting the efficacy of the right to jury trial by erecting a strong presumption of prejudice when the integrity of jury deliberations has been compromised by unauthorized contact with non-jurors. So the question that I was asking Mr. Harrison was, how can you get away from the idea that when there is contact that's unauthorized and therefore an outside influence, there's contact between a juror and a witness being outside influence, that there isn't by its very nature at least a showing that there could be substantial prejudice sufficient to allow for questioning? Why wouldn't it be appropriate to have a bright line in that situation that says that the judge has to allow some questioning?
Well, Bocchini was prior to Guarantani, and prior Furutani kind of laid the framework, and in Furutani, it seems to make clear that we're not having a per se kind of bright line that contact should require jurors to be called in.
Well, the Williamson case that Mr. Harrison was talking about, that's where they brought the dictionary in, and there was some inquiry allowed of the foreperson about how the dictionary was used, but the court pointed out how that kind of outside influence is so significant that questioning the foreperson is not enough. You have to actually bring in the person that had the dictionary, which would seem to emphasize again the significance of the significance of finding that there is substantial prejudice to the right to a fair trial where there has been outside contact.
Well, I think those cases are cases that dealt with external evidence being introduced into the deliberation.
True.
And that has been found itself to be prejudicial because then the juror is not deciding the cases just on the evidence that was admitted in trial.
Do we know whether or not external evidence of that contact wasn't brought into the jury deliberation room? Do we know? Mr. Harrison postulated that perhaps during deliberations, maybe that the testimony of the defense witness came up and he offered his impression of the person.
No, but again, it's the defendant's prima facie burden to make a prima facie showing, and the only evidence defendant presented was Bowen's declaration. And Bowen's declaration makes no kind of assertion like that.
Let me ask you about another piece of evidence to see if you think that was important in addition to Bowen's declaration, because I think you rightfully have noted that there was an instruction that was given to this witness. Specifically, it says, to this juror, and it said, do not talk to the attorneys, defendant, or witnesses, right? So when you talk about evidence that there may have been substantial prejudice, if you've got a juror that is perhaps intentionally, one could find, violating a court order of that significance that's meant to protect the right to a jury trial, wouldn't that be evidence in addition to Bowen's declaration?
Just not following instructions, not by itself, because there's no other evidence that he couldn't follow any other instructions. In fact, we know he voted at least not guilty in at least one count. And that demonstrates that he applied the presumption of innocence, and he found that the state did not meet its burden beyond a reasonable doubt. So there's no other evidence that just because he didn't follow this instruction, it should just be considered prejudicial.
Now, in this case, it came to light because it was a defense witness. And so the defense witness told the defendant, who then Mr. Harrison found out about. Let's suppose it was a prosecution witness. And let's suppose that the prosecution witness and the juror were observed, say, by defense counsel talking for maybe 10 minutes in a bathroom or any place. Under your scenario, could the defendant establish prejudice because he doesn't know any contact and he has no way of talking even to the prosecution witness? Under your scenario, even a 10-minute conversation, I think, may not be enough, because how can you establish prejudice? They could have just been talking about anything.
Is this pre-verdict or post-verdict?
Does it make a difference in your analysis?
Yes, pre-verdict. Post-verdict, we're dealing with 606B limitations as well as the rules of professional conduct that defense counsel stated. Pre-verdict, yeah, it's not a problem. Call in the juror, ask them, did this happen? And they're not impeaching the verdict. They're not attempting to impeach the verdict because there's no verdict yet. But that's why this test exists, to balance the policy concerns about harassing jurors, protecting the sanctity of deliberation, protecting the finality of the verdict with the defendant's right to a fair trial.
So just so I understand, the state's position is if this had been reported to the court prior to the verdict being rendered and the court had denied the request to talk to the juror, that the state would agree that we should vacate this verdict and remand? You said pre-verdict is not pre-verdict. If there was a kind of contact that Justice Pollack described, absolutely call the juror in and talk to him.
I'm saying it's not as difficult to call in the juror and talk to them, yes.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand what you're arguing. Is it your argument that in that case the court should call the juror in?
I think it's the court's call. If the court feels if the evidence presented to the court as to what happened,
You seem to think there's a big distinction between pre-verdict and post-verdict.
Well,
you weigh it differently in some sense?
Well, in one, you're attacking the verdict, and there's some special policy considerations there. That
even if there's misconduct, it's more important to protect the verdict?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that's why we have this Boratani analysis, to kind of balance that. And then keep the court ends up being kind of a gatekeeper.
Ms. McCullen, suppose there actually was, in this case, some sort of juror misconduct. What if the juror did say, this guy, told the other jurors, I asked this guy for a job. He just shined me out. He didn't even give me a response, and I don't like him. Under your analysis, how does that come to the attention of the court then? I mean, if it actually impacted the fairness of the trial, if in fact, of course we don't know that it happened, but suppose it did, and the judge doesn't give the defense attorney a chance to find this out, how do we make sure that all of us, you as a prosecutor, also want a fair trial?
I think it goes to this test. That's why this court created this Boratani analysis. But the defendant, according to this analysis, the defendant must come forth with a prima facie showing that not only, one, there was a misconduct, but two, that it could have substantially prejudiced his or her right to a fair trial.
And how is that not established by a declaration that says that he asked me for a job and I didn't respond?
I think defendant, if we look at defendant's theory, they don't point to anything in this declaration, any statement of Bowen's that established prejudice itself, or that it could be prejudice. Instead, the theory is because there was a non-response, because there was a non-action, that rose to the left, that caused substantial prejudice. But we would have to make several assumptions.
So we were previously speaking about a different scenario. If this had been brought to the trial court's attention before the verdict, do you think the trial court would have had an obligation to allow questioning at that time?
Yes. And let's not forget, it sounds like, according to the declaration, defendant.
So once the verdict is come, once a guilty verdict comes in, then that right disappears.
Well, I don't know if it's a right. It's still within the court's discretion in how the court manages the proceedings before it.
Justice McKenna just asked the same question I was asking. I'm trying to understand. So you're saying if this scenario occurred pre-verdict and was brought to the attention of the judge pre-verdict, the judge should have allowed the questioning. And if the judge didn't allow the questioning, what should we do on appeal? Should we vacate the verdict or not?
It depends. In this case, are you talking about? I mean, it depends on the specifics.
I'm trying to understand the rule you're arguing for. You appear to be conceding that if this had happened before the verdict, that we would have a different outcome in this case. I want to be sure if that's your concession that we understand.
No, I'm just saying that it's easier for the court to call in the jurors.
So it's not that the test is different. It's just that it's somehow easier as a matter of just logistics.
We're not talking about impeaching the verdict.
Okay. Can you reconcile this for me? Our courts have said it's inherent in the protection of the right to a fair trial that a defendant receive a trial by an impartial jury free from outside influences. We've said that before. It's been repeated. There's no distinction made, the outside influence in that formulation, as to when it occurs. And my other problem with this is if the outside influence is transferred from pretrial into the jury deliberation room, why should the test be different?
Well, I'm just saying it's easier for the court to call in, and we're not worried about infringing on the sanctity of deliberations or attacking the or not protecting the finality of the verdict.
Is it the state's position that the finality of the verdict is more important than the defendant's constitutional right to a fair trial?
No, it's a balancing that the court, the defendant must make this prima facie showing before the court can get any further.
Can I just, for the sake of argument, help me with this. For the sake of argument, let's assume that the defendant met the burden of showing deprivation that could substantially prejudice his right to a fair trial, and which creates a rebuttable presumption of prejudice, right? And then the burden shifts to the state to prove harmlessness. In this scenario, how could, assuming we found that that threshold test had been met, how could the state prove harmlessness?
I think in this case, we would look at, as Judge On had stated, the mixed verdicts show that the jury was impartial. They took the evidence, applied it to the count, found that in some cases.
So as a matter of law, as long as there's an acquittal on one count, it's harmless?
No, not as a matter of law. It's just a way to look at the, it's one example to show that the jury was impartial.
Is there any other way that you think the state could have proven harmlessness if we had gotten to that point?
We would have to, well, before we would get to that point, the court would hold a hearing to look at the surrounding circumstances, the totality of the surrounding circumstances. And whatever comes out through that testimony, the state would be able to apply to a harmlessness argument.
But Justice McKenna, I think what she's indicating is that it's a totality of circumstances test, as you've just indicated. What a court would have to do is base their decision not on a totality, but based on one circumstance, which you contend, which would be the verdict. Because there's no other circumstances to evaluate, because the juror who could have helped you dispel this was never called.
There was also a witness there. There are two people at this contact. And if anything came
out... Didn't he submit a declaration?
Yes, and there's... If anything came out during that contact that would have prejudiced the defendant, he would have and should have put it in this declaration.
But again, I know you've been asked this. I'm not sure how the witness would know what the juror did with that information, that contact, that communication, his impressions of the meeting, and what that particular juror did with it.
The witness could testify or could put put in his declaration if there was nonverbal cues or any statements made by the juror about the defendant, the testimony, anything. But this declaration that was presented is very vague. It provides no, it didn't give the court anything in here to find prejudice. And I think the defendant kind of admitted that when the theory was, because it was a non-response, that was the prejudice.
You mentioned nonverbal cues, which I guess goes back to this idea of what should be determined in order to find substantial prejudice. What would be the nature of the inquiry that would be needed by the court in order to meet its burden to exercise discretion in an informed way about whether there was substantial prejudice? And wouldn't a judge want to know what that interaction was like? Will you have a witness being approached by a juror contrary to an order of the court? The kind of nonverbal circumstances might have something to do with whether the court finds that there is substantial prejudice, because maybe this is an individual that for some reason this juror is frustrated. Maybe it's a juror that for some reason isn't particularly stable. Wouldn't you consider that, I think you've conceded, that's a very significant inappropriate contact, right? For a witness to be approached by a juror and be given a request. And it wasn't a request to, let's have lunch. The request was, help me with a job, which in the normal scheme of things, generally considered pretty important in a person's life, right? To get a job. So along with that, the nonverbal communication seems to me would be something that the judge could get a sense of, right? Wouldn't that be important?
Well, yes, and the witness here, so again, there are two people. The witness gave a declaration, and this declaration did meet one of those two parts in the prima facie showing, but it did not meet the second part. And to apply defendant's theory to try to meet the second part, we'd have to make assumptions. Like the juror, who, by the way, was recently retired after serving 20 years in the Navy, we would have to assume that he...
And out of a job, according to what you just stated.
Recently retired, yes. We'd have to assume that he expected to hear back.
Well, somebody who's just out of job, 20 years, just retired, giving a card with all that personal information. It is a pretty bold act for a juror, instructed by a judge to say, don't contact witnesses, for someone to go into a bathroom and hand a card and say, hey, and we're expected to assume that juror put it all aside, did nothing with it, didn't use that fact in the deliberations, didn't tell another juror, didn't approach another witness in the proceedings. I mean, we're having to make a lot of suppositions for a juror that seems to me, as Justice Wilson just said, may have issues.
I don't think that's in the record at all. I don't think that this juror had issues in the record, and I don't think the declaration shows that at all.
What about if the juror said, let's have lunch after this is all over? Problem?
Maybe, depending what the declaration said. Again,
it says exactly that. I was approached in the bathroom, and the juror said, I'd like to have lunch with you, and this is all over.
When this is all, I mean, if they're not discussing the case, the witness's testimony, the evidence, if there's no indication that there's any prejudice against defendant, then defendant's not meeting the second part of the prima facie showing.
Does it not indicate at least a fair inference that perhaps the juror is not focusing on his or her obligations to just be following the law and paying attention to the facts in the case?
I don't think that's a reasonable inference from one comment of let's have lunch after this.
Following up on the Chief Justice's point about how to analyze the seriousness of this and whether it would show bad judgment, a juror is a judge, correct?
Of the facts, yes.
Yeah. So if a judge of the facts that was a judge of the state decided to give his card to witness or her card to a witness and speak about doing some, I don't know, arbitration work or doing some work after retirement. Doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the facts of the case, but would that strike you as a situation in which you would want to be able to ask some questions about what that was all about?
Again, it meets the first part of the test. But in this case,
which part of the test doesn't it meet?
The prejudicial part. What was prejudice?
You don't think that could be prejudicial to have the judge going into the bathroom and talking to the witness on the other side of your case? Well, this is a judge. A juror is a judge. That's what I mean. What if the judge in this case decided to do that?
Well, again, it shows improper conduct, but we need to have a showing of prejudice. And I see that my time is up, and I'm hoping I can...
I'll let you finish your answer to this question, and I'll let you wrap up, and there may be other questions. So.
Okay, I just wanted to address, I think it was Justice Nakayama's question about a remedy. I do think that because the circuit court ended prior to having any kind of totality of the circumstances, should this court find abuse of discretion, that would be the remedy, to go back and have this hearing, first call in the witness, and ask more questions, see if we need to call in the juror, and then if need be, call in the juror.
When was his trial?
2013.
And do you have any specific case where they've directed 2.5 years or so afterwards to question jurors about what occurred?
I didn't see any case saying that we can't.
Well, is that because the reason that you haven't seen any cases that can't is because those cases where they haven't done it, like in the Hawaii cases, what they've done is vacated and remanded for a new trial?
That did occur in cases where the jurors were called in and the court went the other way.
This trial was March 2013, wasn't it? Late March? Okay.
I believe so.
Ms. McCullen, anything else that you had to wrap up at this point?
No, thank you.
Well, Mr. Harrison, your rebuttal.
Chief Justice, I don't know how much time I have left, but you have
five and a half minutes.
Thank you.
Mr. Harrison, can you address Ms. McCullen's contention that this is a non-response? How can a non-response be enough to show prejudice or an outside influence into the or improper influence on a jury deliberations?
I don't believe you have to have any verbal communication. I think there's a case, I think it was the Trammell case, the Stroke versus Trammell case, in which the wife was on the jury and the husband was making faces at the wife during the course of the closing argument, and the court found that was communication, just non-verbal communication.
You don't have that here.
No,
it's
nothing. I understand that. But the fact of the matter is that the juror obviously expected some response from the witness in the case. Otherwise, he wouldn't have given him the card, as Justice Pollack says, with all the information on it to contact him. And the non-response, the question then becomes, how does that, if it, or how does it affect the case? And that's the question. And the bottom line here is we wanted that question answered very simply during the course of this trial, or simply soon after the trial, to have the juror come in and question a juror relative to that matter.
If the requirement is outside evidence, one of the reasons that a hearing would be indicated would be outside evidence or outside influence. Is non-response outside evidence?
The non-response being non-response from the witness or the juror?
From the witness.
Under the circumstances, I would argue yes, that in that situation where there's an expectation of some kind of response, since the person, as Justice Pollack indicated, was bold enough to go into a bathroom and give him the card with all that information and direct contravention of the order, then I'm concerned if there is no response. I'm concerned if that non-response did in fact his thinking and other jurors' thinking.
How do you respond to the state and the trial judge's reasoning that the acquittal on one count shows that there was no prejudice?
Well, for instance, we have situations where jurors are in there. We don't know what they're thinking, but let's just give some hypotheticals. We have multiple jurors determining multiple counts. And I've talked to jurors after, sometimes this horse trading goes on in the jury deliberations. And it shouldn't be, but in fact it happens. And compromises take place in there. Even if that fact factored into that compromise, it infected the trial. And so just the mere fact that there were inconsistent or mixed, not inconsistent, but mixed verdicts here doesn't get away from the fact that what happened to that witness and that juror did not somehow prejudice my client's right to a fair trial.
If these facts meet the standard of a rebuttable presumption of prejudice, can you think of a way that the state would be able to, any other way? Well, let's assume that actually the trial judge had allowed the questioning. Can you think of a way that the state may have been able to prove harmlessness?
Well, assuming they're going to talk, the judge is going to talk to the juror and ask the juror point blank questions about what happened, and the general tendency is to ask the question, did that in any way influence your decision making, et cetera, et cetera.
How could the judge even ask that?
Well, the judge in that situation after the trial is over is going to ask the juror, number one, why did you do this? Did you expect a response from Mr. Bowen? And if the juror said yes, I expect a response, I think at that point,
what if the juror says the conversation never took place, that the witness is making it up?
He could say that, and the judge would have to make determinations of credibility. Now, a business card from the foreperson.
Good point.
Sort of, you know.
What if the witness? What if the juror says it didn't? I was not expecting a response, and it didn't impact me at all. Is that sufficient? I was not expecting a response.
I would argue that after he made that comment, and we had to argue this motion to the judge, I would say, well, in that situation, that's disingenuous. Why would you give a card to someone and ask them for a job and not expect a response from the individual?
So are you basically arguing that under these circumstances, even despite the question, there's no way that the state could have been able to prove harmlessness?
Under the circumstances of this case, I'm arguing that I think that I have a difficult time proving harmlessness. And one of the things that we've determined today, which we've never determined in the past, the state never admitted this, but the fact that there was contact, the state indicates today that's inappropriate contact. And I think that initially, when we come to the question of whether I made my prima facie case, we made it at that point, if they admit that this contact was improper.
How do you respond to the state's argument that there should be a different test based on whether it's pre-verdict or post-verdict?
Well, and I would address the other justices' concerns, and your concern, you can't balance fair trial with expeditiousness or easiness. She's indicating that it would be easier in a trial setting when the juror made that contact when we're in trial to call the juror back and have the juror question the juror. But again, we're talking about the right, fundamental right in the Sixth Amendment in Article 1, Section 14, a right to a fair trial, a right to a level playing field. Okay. Any more further questions? Or my time's
up. Did you have anything you wanted to wrap up? Or?
I would just note that what we have here simply is that we have to protect the sanctity of the jury process. And when we have this kind of conduct going on, then even appearance of impropriety is what we have to guard against. And the court has to delve into that issue and make a determination to assure the defendant and the public that everyone gets a right to a fair trial. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harrison. The court will take this matter under advisement. And before we leave the bench, I'd just like to thank both of our counsel here today for participating in our argument in this very unique venue. And I want to thank the students, faculty, and administrators of the law school for welcoming us here tonight. And we have a very long-standing and very strong relationship between the Richardson School of Law and the judiciary. It's benefited the community in many different ways through our efforts to increase access to justice. And Dean Soifer has been just a great leader in that effort. Assisting with the launch of our new environmental court. Dean Antolini has helped us there and supporting our efforts to take the Supreme Court out in the community. The students in the Spoche program have been helping us prepare for students in the high schools for those oral arguments. And we're going to go to Kauai later this month, and we expect to have about 400 students attend our oral argument. So we really appreciate the support from the SCOGE program for that effort as well. And we have, of course, many, many other ties, our externs, law clerks, judges, justices like Justice McKenna, who are graduates of the school. And it's a very, very gratifying to see our former colleague, Justice Simi Nakoba, teaching at the school, and of course, Chief Judge Burns, who's always here and always, I think, providing guidance and advice and to all the students here at the school. And it's, again, just one more symbol of how close the relationship is between the law school and the judiciary. And we very much value the opportunity to be here tonight. I want to thank everyone who made that possible, Dean Soifer, Dean Antolini, Dean Kawakami. They've been very, very gracious. We appreciate their help. I want to thank Jennifer Young and Chongmin Wai for their help as well. And we look forward to having a chance to meet with the students shortly. And once again, I want to thank everyone who came tonight and thank our attorneys for participating in the argument here. And we have nothing further at this time, so the court will stand in recess. Thank you.
Please rise. This honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned. Please be seated.